Blog Talk Radio.
Look out, evildoers! There's a new crime fighter in town! Here comes the Blue Roofie!
Unhand her, criminal scum! Prepare to be brought to justice! But first,
can I buy you a drink?
I'll tell you, these sponsors get weirder and weirder. Okay, we're on the air. This is the V-Spot. I'm Dr. Vic Tater. Today I'm talking to former Spider-Man editor and comic book writer and current comic book writer Danny Fingeroff. Danny, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I guess what I'll just start with is, how did you get into comics?
I was always a big fan and a reader as a kid. I started reading probably before a lot of your listeners were born. In the Mort Weisinger days of the Superman comics, and then I was right there at the perfect age for Lee and Kirby and Ditko's Marvel Revolution. So I went to college, got a degree in filmmaking, wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and had a chance to get an entry-level job at Marvel, where I became the assistant editor to Larry Lieber on what was then called the British Department. That was comics that were repurposed for print on a weekly basis in England. And that was how I got in.
Okay, did you do any work on the comics that they were making over there, like Captain Britain?
I did. I was involved with Captain Britain near the end when it was, the way the circulation worked in England was actually not unlike what turned out to be the direct market here. But they were constantly launching new titles and combining titles. So I think when I got there, it was maybe called Super Spider-Man and Captain Britain. And it was after Claremont and I think Trimpey were the original creative team. It was Jim Lawrence was writing it, and the art was switched off each week between Pablo Marcos and Ron Wilson. So, yeah, but I was involved in probably the last year or so of the Captain Britain stories that were produced in the U.S.
Okay. Did you have any work on it when Alan Davis and Alan Moore were doing it?
Yes and no. I was at a certain point, the British operation, oddly enough, transferred to Britain. We always had a British office where the assistant editor... Here's a little trivia footnote: is the assistant editor in the British office that was in England was a guy named Neil Tennant, who went on to become one of the Pet Shop Boys. But he was my counterpart, and Larry and I did the editorial over in the U.S. And then at a certain point, it got taken over by a guy named Des Skin, who people may know from Warrior magazine, and he did.
Yeah.
He did the British version of a Mad magazine, and now he's still active on the Internet. But Des convinced the company to actually have the British comics put out by actual British people. What a concept, huh? And so that's, I think he got Alan Davis. I'm not sure who did the strip then, but it was people who, a lot of the people that Des got involved, and then later Paul Neary got involved with British Marvel, with David Lloyd and Alan Moore and Alan Davis, and a lot of people who are household names now got their start working with British Marvel. So I was not directly involved with those comics, although I think I may have helped out on some of the reprint editions in the States.
Okay, so let me ask about this, because I'm curious about how this would work. What would the American offices, when would it be necessary for them to step in on one of the British comics? And they can't do this.
Again, when we were producing the material over here, I don't think there was ever, since we knew, we were literally packaging it, it would... in those days, we would put it together on black and white photostats, which is a precursor to photocopies, but you need a big, giant machine, literally a giant camera, to make these things. They'd have to, you know, be bathed in a chemical bath for an amount of time for them to be usable. You know, and then they would, then the boards would go to a motorcycle messenger who would take it to the airport, and the boards would fly to England on a big jet plane, and then another motorcycle messenger would pick it up at the airport and bring it to the Marvel offices. And a couple of times we had them fall off the motorcycles at one end or the other, which necessitated going back and recreating the entire comic. It wasn't original art, it was photostats, but it represented a lot of work. So when it went over to England for the production and creation, I don't remember ever, you know, they were pretty independent. I don't think we ever had that kind of approval. Maybe later on in the 90s when the books... when during the big boom, Marvel UK started putting out a lot of comics. I was not involved with it then. I don't know if there was anybody who had approval. I think the general feeling was that those stories took place in some kind of alternate timeline, that they weren't, that they didn't count towards continuity in the States. So I don't think it was... I don't think there was anybody whose task it was to watch that stuff particularly, except, you know, I would imagine there was somebody whose job, as far as bookkeeping and royalties, you know, they had that kind of financial oversight. But I don't remember anybody ever being asked to approve or disapprove any of the stories they were doing.
All right. What was your first job working on the American line at Marvel?
Excuse me. Boy, this is really inside baseball you're asking here. When I was in the British department was another office at Marvel's, at Marvel's overall offices when they were at 575 Madison Avenue. And so I think there were various times where there were random tasks that needed to be done on the American books, doing inventory of inventory. In other words, seeing what was in the flat files. Especially, I remember having one time to go through all the black and white files and see what we had that hadn't been printed or could be reprinted. But I'd say the first thing that you would have seen a credit for me would have been as reprint editor. There was a line of reprint comics we put out in the, I think in 1979 and 1980, Fantasy Masterpieces, Marvel's Greatest Comics, a few others. I think the reason, at least the reason was always told to me that we suddenly put out so many reprints was that we had a commitment for a certain number of copies that our advertising clients' ads would be seen in, and we weren't hitting that, so we had to rush a line of reprint books out, and I was allowed to put my name in as reprint editor. So that's probably where people would have seen me. I did a lot of work with Sal Brodsky and Irene Vartanoff on special projects as well, and then... probably the most high-profile thing would have been when Louise Jones, who became Louise Simonson, was hired from Warren Comics. I became her assistant, and so my name was in all the Conan, Star Wars, Star Trek, X-Men, Man-Thing, Dazzler. We did, you know, the workloads then were astonishing. The amount of material, Micronauts. We must have put out from our office and all the editorial offices must have put out somewhere between 12 and 20 titles a month.
Let me ask you, I've never really thought about this. What was the job of the assistant editor?
the job of the assistant editor. You'll have to put up with my call waiting beep. So sorry about that. The job of the assistant editor was sort of defined differently in each office and each company, but it could range. Certainly in the days before we had a lot of interns, it would be the basic clerical stuff like filing, sorting, putting packages together, either of scripts to send to the artist or pencils to send to the inker or the letterer. Or the editor's office tends to be sort of like the hub on the spokes of a wheel. Everything comes to the editor's office, and in the bygone dark ages before the internet, there was no such thing as sending things digitally. Everything came in, physically in paper to the office and was sent out. So the assistant, so the basic clerical stuff, the making appointments, fielding phone calls, dealing with letters pages, picking letters and either writing the answers or assigning the answers to somebody. There was a certain amount of training involved too. So I know I got to edit some comics that were kind of lower profile. I got to edit Man-Thing and Kazar, comics that were either low profile and or had creative teams that could pretty much be trusted to do good quality work without a lot of tinkering. That wasn't always true. And then sometimes there would be stories by new writers or aspiring writers that would require a lot of attention. It gave you sort of a way to be mentored by an editor, and while helping out with necessary office tasks and getting over being starstruck by big name creators, because that's a big thing to learn. It's kind of it's always interesting in any field, but there's somebody, especially something as high profile as comics, where you kind of meet your childhood idols, and you suddenly at one there's some point where you always have to go, "Hello, childhood idol, I've admired your work since I was a child. I can't believe I'm talking to you, and it's really great. Now, where's the pages?" Right. You promised the work yesterday. Where is it? So you sort of, there's everybody deals with that in a in a different way, but that's that's probably one of the most important things you learn as an assistant, is kind of how to, here's this person that I've spent my entire life, admiring and aspiring to be like. But now I have to do something unpleasant to or with them, and how do I do that? That's among the hardest lessons to learn as an assistant. So that's, but every office has a different mode. There are some, it has to do with management style. There are some editors who delegate everything out and only see a comic when it's about to go to the printer. There are some editors, and in that way, as their assistant, you need to be capable of making decisions on your own and not getting freaked out when things go wrong. And then there are other editors who are more who want to have more control and are involved in a very hands-on way from the moment the a plot idea is pitched by a writer. And then in that case, the assistant's role is, has less pressure on it in terms of making high-level decisions, but it is more of sort of what you would think of as something an intern does around an office these days. I could go on and on about this, but I think that's somewhat of an answer to your question.
Okay. Was Cyforce your first writing credit?
No. You see, don't go by Wikipedia. I'll tell it to everybody. My Wikipedia entry is riddled with mistakes. Including where and when I started in the business. Wikipedia puts me as starting 3 years earlier than I did, because my first boss, Larry Lieber, had been editing over at Atlas Seaboard in the mid-70s. That was the company Martin Goodman started after he left, after he sold Marvel and left. So Larry had been editing over there, and because Larry was my first boss, unfortunately, that information is on Jerry Bale's website, and Jerry passed away, and my understanding is that his widow is not interested in updating anything on his site. So no matter how many times friends of mine correct when I started in the business or anything else, it always goes back to me starting 3 years earlier than I did at a different company. So the first I did a lot of writing that was uncredited on the British books. We would write new recap splash pages and to bring people up to date. And I wrote a lot of letters pages for both the American and the British titles. I think the first credit I had was as a co-writer on a two-part Avengers story. And then it might have been the Dazzler. I don't know if there was anything in between, but no.
Now I remember that.
Yeah, my first regular title was the Dazzler.
Okay, yeah, I just blanked on that because I was reading that the other night.
Hmm?
I was reading that the other night. I was doing research the other night, and I still remember that.
Oh yeah, the Dazzler was, you know, it was Jim Shooter was editing. I was editing it, and then I became the writer through a series of strange circumstances, and Jim Shooter became the hands-on editor, and so that was a big training process for me. You know, and it was a challenge because nobody took the Dazzler seriously. On the other hand, it was a weird situation. Nobody took it seriously, but because it had been a high-profile comic, because it was the first one to go direct only, it had a lot of attention on it. Nobody took it seriously, but it had a lot of attention, which meant sales were good. And, you know, me and Jim and Frank Springer and Vinnie Coletta really did what we could to make it a book that would be taken seriously in Marvel continuity, although I will admit that the Dazzler took more showers than most other superheroes, at least more showers that we saw on screen.
Well, you know, hygiene's very important.
Mm-hmm. She was a very clean superhero. But it did kind of fall along the lines of the classic Marvel formula of a reluctant hero who wants to have some version of a normal life, albeit she wanted to be a famous singer, but she, you know, had the personal conflicts and the soap opera aspects, and then, you know, we had her go up against Galactus, you know, which I thought, it's one of those stories that I read back and I go, wow, those stories are better than they had any right to be. That was pretty amazing.
Now, to use Galactus, would you have to go through the Fantastic Four office?
Well, having the editor-in-chief as the editor of the book probably smoothed the rails on that, you know. At different times, you know, over the years I was there, the system of permissions and so on went through different permutations. But yeah, you would certainly at least have to notify the office that was in charge of a particular character. So I'm trying to, was there? I guess there probably was I guess whoever was editing Fantastic Four probably had to approve the usage of the character and then the plots themselves and then the book when it came out. There were different, you know, over the years and under different regimes and philosophies, sometimes you just had to notify someone so that you could be sure the continuity was right, but they couldn't withhold permission, but other times they could withhold permission, but not forever. There have been a period where, say, you know, that there was veto power from a given office, or even from the writer of a given book, over what could be done with the characters from that book. I think that started to loosen up, and again, this is one of those things where, you know, something like Sean Howe's new book is probably could tell detail more what the rules were at different times. I lost my train of thought here, oddly enough. But there were. You couldn't just use characters willy-nilly, certainly. So with using Galactus in the Dazzler, we would have to get the permission from whoever was editing the Fantastic Four.
Okay. Now, when you were doing Cyforce, I asked about this because I was on a kick of reading New Universe comics a few months ago.
Uh-huh.
And I thought you were the first person on Cyforce to do some really strong single-issue stories with the concept. I was just curious, did you find it difficult to write that book?
Difficult, difficult in what sense? Is there a specific thing you were thinking of?
Well, it seems like with the new universe, you couldn't really have a new supervillain show up just because of the concept of that line, that you couldn't just, you know, create a new supervillain, and a lot of the characters' powers in the book, they weren't necessarily... I wouldn't say they were necessarily visually appealing.
Well, I think Cyforce wasn't pretty visual. I mean, they didn't have, you know, look, the rule, and then the rules changed, you know, again, whatever the rules were changed every couple of months. You know, I think the idea was to have a universe that just had that, you know, so-called white event that created the characters and their powers, you know, but not have aliens and not have subterranean races and not have magic. You know, it would be, you know, a world that was more like the world outside your window, is the phrase we used to use. Of course, once you introduce super human characters into it, it's no longer the world outside your window. So I think nobody ever challenged me on creating new villains for that. I mean, that was sort of part of the mandate, actually. I think the good news and bad news about that was that any superhuman character had their origin in the white event. There's a theory that was the beyond. I forget, was that tied into Secret Wars 2 or vice versa? Somehow that was tied in with.
I remember reading an old issue of Marvel Age, and people had wrote in letters asking about that, and for some reason in Marvel Age, they were very insistent that it was not tied in Secret Wars 2 at all, but a lot of people believed it was, but for some reason, because I used to read Marvel Age all the time, so I find it in quarter bins, but
right.
They were very insistent that it was not connected, but I would have thought that would have been a good ideal, but
yeah,
I think...
You know, look, Marvel Age, of course, was the official. I mean, it was very good, and Jim Salicrup did a terrific job with it. But it was, and I think he was followed by, preceded by Steve Saffel. So it was an excellent magazine, but it was the house organ of Marvel. So this goes back a long time. For whatever reason, maybe the official word was that they weren't related, but I think it was pretty much assumed, even by us, that the white event was somehow connected to the Secret Wars. I think that was, you know, one of those back doors that writers and editors build in, so if they need to use it or need to establish it, or need to have some way to cross over the universes. In a way, it was easier to write those the new universe titles because you didn't have 25 years of continuity that you had to go through and make sure you weren't violating something to do with a particular character or team or villain. And of course, again, once you introduce superheroes, you have the basic superhero quandaries. Plus, working with Mark Texera, oh my God, What a pleasure. Holy cow.
Yeah, that was some really nice art.
Man, oh, man. Yeah, that guy was and is astonishing. So, I would say the problems were no different than that in any other book, in that you have an idea, maybe your editor doesn't like it or wants to go a different way, or the artist wants to, it was just sort of the kind of challenges that one faces in collaborative work in general. I guess sort of interesting to discover the rules of that universe as you went along. The mandate was that it's, but really that in a way, that was the mandate of the Marvel Universe, although that was violated in the very first Marvel Universe story. If you Fantastic Four number one, Fantastic Four it introduced that Marvel concept of, what if characters more like real people and living in something more like the world that we live in. What if superheroes were introduced to that world? But of course, FF number one had the Mole Man and his subterranean race of a mole people on Monster Island. So if that established the parameters consciously or not for what would become the Marvel Universe, then the new universe was a more intentional aim to do that. I think as time went on, and as the original creative teams left and other people came on and other editorial teams, I think, those rules became forgotten. And again, even within, even if the rule was no aliens, no whatever, right? I mean, the Star brand, I think, started from the premise of an alien giving Ken Connell those powers. So, it's all well and good to kind of make these ground rules and guidelines, but in the end, I think bottom line is, if it's something that makes for a good story, you're going to do it.
How did you get the job as editor of the Spider-Man line?
Well, I was the editor of the Spider-Man line two different times. In the 80s, It was. I think I was due to be promoted, and I was promoted, and that was the next line that came open. It was that simple and that complicated. I'd been there several years, and I'd worked with Louise. I actually worked on Spider-Man as a guest star when I was editing Kazar under Louise's supervision. And, it's sort of hard to do any line of Marvel books, except for Conan, I guess, without having guest stars, Wolverine, Spider-Man, The Thing, whoever coming in. So I'd had some experience with Spider-Man, but it really, there were no editorial royalties then. I think if there were creators' royalties, it was just the beginning in terms of writers and artists. So, it was pretty much that simple. Tom DeFalco had been promoted to be Shooter's, I forget what Tom's title was, but he was basically the second in command in editorial. And I was the next assistant in line to be promoted, and it was, so Tom left the Spider-Man titles open. I liked Spider-Man. I can't say that I had any special affinity for the character, but I got to like the character a lot more once I was working on him. Actually, I got to appreciate it in a way that I hadn't even as a kid. As a kid, my favorites were the Fantastic Four and Iron Man and Daredevil and Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I collected Spider-Man, but it wasn't. It didn't. I think Spider-Man is a comic that whole subtext is kind of about becoming an adult and surviving in the workplace. I think it's both because of Ditko's interest and because of Stan's interests and the way the character lent himself to Marvel was always about that. You know, the Marvel characters always had those issues of survival that a lot of other characters didn't. You know, Clark Kent could make lumps of coal into diamonds. He didn't need, you know, he could dig gold out of the earth. He could do, I mean, he didn't have his job as a reporter because he needed to make money. You know, Peter Parker had his job as a photographer because he needed the money to support himself and Aunt May. Even the Fantastic Four, there were issues where they lost their money in the and Submariner, tried to ruin them. Which, and later on, Frank Miller did, many years later, did similar things with the Born Again storyline with Daredevil. So that, I was editor of Spider-Man for a couple of years in the 80s when he first got the black costume, and when the Hobgoblin was very prominent as a villain. It was during the Stern Romita Jr. and the Friends DeFalco era, which a lot of people remember as some of the best stuff. Then I went freelance for a number of years. I came back on staff in the late 80s, and by that point there were editorial royalties, and I thought for sure I'd walked away from the Spider-Man books in the 80s. I figured, well, I'll never see them again, or the kind of financial success that they brought with them. But things happen in offices and companies, and suddenly one day, I mean, it was very funny, because I had been having an argument with Tom DeFalco, who's a good buddy, but in a high-stress work situation, people will have arguments, and Tom and I have been arguing about something that morning, I don't even remember what, and he called me into his office late that afternoon, and I figured we were going to continue the argument, and that's when he told me that I was becoming the editor of the Spider-Man books again, so that was... I hadn't expected that. I thought we were going to be continuing our jousting over whatever topic we had been fighting about in the morning. But instead, I suddenly got these books back, which I had never—I thought I would never see again.
Okay, you were editor during Maximum Carnage, weren't you?
I was indeed. Well, Maximum Carnage.
All right. How did it? How did that story come about? How did the idea for that come about? And how would coordinating all of those books go with different writers?
For the clone storyline, you mean, or for?
Maximum Carnage.
Maximum Carnage. The one. Okay. Maximum. Not Clonage. Carnage.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Maximum. Well, look. Don't forget the era was the era of the giant crossover. The X-Men, I think, were doing these massive multi-part crossovers, probably some of the other books as well. And I can't say that anybody ever told me to do it in Spider-Man. On the other hand, it seemed to be a popular thing to do, and we were already coordinating the books because, you have one character, and you want their concerns to be consistent. You don't want them to inadvertently fight the same villain. So that's how the group. That's why the group editor system came about. Anyway, was to have consistency within a character. excuse me, within a character line. So Maximum Carnage. And we were going to launch the Spider-Man Unlimited. At that point there were. Unlimited or Ultimate? Jesus, what was it?
I believe it was Unlimited.
It was Unlimited. It was a line of quarterly comics to be printed on slick paper that were 64 pages or maybe even 80 pages, a lot of material. And again, it was because we were in the boom period of the early 90s, and so it was a boom period. It was a period of the multi-part crossover, and we were going to be launching Unlimited Spider-Man, or Spider-Man Unlimited. Spider-Man Unlimited? Probably Spider-Man Unlimited, because that way it could have been racked with the other Spider-Man titles alphabetically. I think it was my idea, and I came up with an outline for the writers, which they then, you know, tore to pieces and made their own. You know, there was, you know, editorial oversight and control of the books was not a new phenomenon of the 2000s, as people may think. It was happening in the 80s and 90s, and this was just, you know, I came in with a loose outline. My about every 6 months, we would get together with all the Spider-Man writers, and once a year with the writers and the artists. And I always felt it was my responsibility as the group editor of the books to come in with a fallback plan. So I would say, I've got the next 6 months planned out. It's probably not that good, but we have to come out of this meeting with something, so it's up to you guys to come up with something better. And then we can, you know, that I, as the group editor, will concede is better, and then we can drop my ideas. You know, and that happened a lot of times. Somehow Maximum Carnage, though, the writers, they either liked it enough or at least didn't hate it enough to refuse to do it, and Carnage and Venom were very popular then as well. That was how that came about. It was, you know, those multi-part stories are always problematic for the writers because you can find yourself writing, you know, part 3 and 8 of 15, and even if let's say the guy writing part 7 is a fast writer, but the guy writing part 6 or the artist doing part 6 is slower, then you could have, you know, the later chapters complete and ready to go earlier, but if the person or people doing the earlier one don't exactly follow the guideline and the plan that everybody agreed to, then suddenly you're doing rewriting and redrawing to make the two issues follow each other logically. So it's, you know, on the one hand, having a plan and an overview is very helpful, except that, you know, humans don't always do what you tell them to or do it the way you expect they will. So that could lead to interesting last-minute scrambling. But, yeah, I guess I would have to take, unless somebody has a different memory, which I'm sure they'll let you know if I'm wrong, but my memory is that I at least came in with the basic idea and outline for Maximum Carnage purely as a way to sell more comics, which is what my job was.
Okay, can you tell me about the Stanley Universe?
The Stanley Universe is a book that came out about a year and a half ago from Tomorrow's Publishing. They're the people who do the Jack Kirby Collector and Back Issue Magazine and Alter Ego. And when Stan turned 85, which is 5 years ago because he just turned 90, I did an issue of Right Now magazine, which was a magazine I was doing for them. It was kind of Writer's Digest for comics and animation. And I did an 85th birthday tribute to Stan, and simultaneously Roy did an 85th birthday tribute to Stan in Alter Ego. And, you know, Roy and Stan, of course, had worked together in the 60s. Roy was the first assistant editor that Stan ever hired in the Marvel era. And at one point I just said, you know, well, why don't we just put our two issues together and make a special issue out of it or a book? And then I got the I knew Stan had his archives in the University of Wyoming at Laramie, which has, I know it seems like an odd place, but because it's not in New York or L.A., but it has a lot of entertainment business and media people's archives, and they, you know, they have more, as far as comics, they have Mort Weisinger's archives there, and they're looking to expand to other comics editors. They asked me for my archives, which was kind of flattering. And I knew that I couldn't get stuff by remote control because it was the listings were a little vague, and I tried to get some stuff for the issue of Right Now, and they sent me technically what I asked for, but not what I thought what I was getting. Through no fault of theirs, they're wonderful people out there, but they're, you know, there's 90 boxes of Stan Lee stuff, and you know, including boxes that are labeled, say, radio and television interviews 1947 to 1980, and you go, well, okay. That's kind of vague. So I went out So we decided to make the book more than just a combination of what Roy and I had done. We decided to make it sort of the ultimate Stan Lee archive and memorabilia and rarity book. So I spent a week finding all sorts of cool stuff out in Wyoming at Stan's archives, going through dozens and dozens of those boxes and finding letters from people like Mario Puzo and Tom Wolfe and Oliver Stone and just anybody who is anybody in pop culture or even highbrow culture in the era when Stan was editor and publisher of Marvel is represented and script and notes from Jack Kirby about the Silver Surfer graphic novel that they did in the late 70s. It was I think the last thing they worked on together. Transcripts of interviews of Stan debating Frederick Wortham's right hand woman, a woman named Hilda Mossey. That was on the radio in 1968 on a show called The Barry Farber Show. Lee and Kirby on an obscure show that was broadcast locally in New York. So I found all this stuff that had not been seen or heard for 40 or more years, and had the interviews transcribed. And so the book is full of all sorts of rarities like that, plus material from Alter Ego and Right Now, which I think not that many people have seen. So that's what the Stan Lee Universe is. It's available at www.tomorrows.com. Tomorrow is spelled TWOMORROWS. It's two people named Morrow who founded the company. So tomorrows.com. And look up the Stan Lee Universe. It's in paperback. It's in a hardcover edition, which has bonus color pages that the paperback doesn't. And it's in digital edition, too, which is all color and is so ridiculously cheap that I don't know how we're making any money on it at all. But if you're not a paper, if you have no more room for any paper in your home, the digital edition may be the way to go. It's check it out and take a look at it. There's free previews online. Anyway, that's what the Stan Lee Universe is.
Okay, Danny, we're about to be cut off in about a minute or two, thank you very much for joining us. Maybe you can come back some other time.
I would love to do that. Somebody say it's Will Eisner Week, willeisnerweek.com. There's a lot of events going on in a dozen cities. Will's birthday is actually today. Will would have been 96 today, so I'm running for the Eisner Foundation. I'm the chair of the Will Eisner Week Organizing Committee. If you ever liked Eisner, graphic novels, comics, check out Something Must Be Happening Near You. But thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
All right. No problem. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciated it.
Okay. You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Next week on The Blue Roofie.
Merciful Martini! I've been knocked out by my arch-nemesis, Corporal Chloroform! Must reach GHB packet and slip it into his beverage!